This is the ethanol report from the National Ethanol Conference. With me is Jeff Cooper with the Renewable Fuels Association. We're going to chat a little bit about the RFS2 rule from EPA and how that compares to what California still intends to do, which really locks corn ethanol out of the California market. Jeff, let's first talk about what the RFS2, as it stands, the rule that came out of EPA, what that means for the ethanol industry.
Sure. Well, the RFS2 program obviously is an expansion of the first renewable fuel standard. And the RFS2 provides requirements for blending renewable fuels that increase up to 36 billion gallons per year by 2022. When EPA had put out their proposed rule back in the middle part of 2009, we were very concerned about a lot of the elements that we saw in that proposal. And one area of great concern to us was EPA's life cycle analysis on corn ethanol. You may remember that under the RFS2, to qualify for that program and to generate RINs, credits under that program, you have to meet a certain greenhouse gas reduction threshold. And for corn ethanol, you have to show that your fuel reduces greenhouse gas emissions 20% or more compared to gasoline to qualify for the RFS2. In the proposed rule back in May of 2009, EPA had found that corn ethanol may or may not reduce GHGs by that required 20%. And at that time, it was their feeling that probably most modern corn ethanol wouldn't. So obviously, we thought that was entirely wrong and a very jaundiced view of the industry. The reason that the EPA came to that conclusion is because they were saddling ethanol, corn ethanol, with these indirect land use change emissions, which you've heard us talk about before, just the great uncertainty, the tremendous unfairness of applying those emissions to corn ethanol while not looking at indirect emissions for any other fuels. So we're obviously greatly concerned. The final rule that came out made several badly needed modifications to the program, to the proposed rule, and EPA now, after updating a lot of the assumptions that go into their modeling and making various other changes, is now saying that corn ethanol that wouldn't be grandfathered under the program would still qualify and would reduce greenhouse gases by around 21%. So it was a major step forward for the RFS2 program.
So that was a good thing, but one of the things that concerned RFA about this is that they still showed that, sugarcane ethanol is better than corn ethanol. When we had somebody from the EPA here, they were specifically asked that, and I really didn't understand the answer. What is their answer to that?
Well, we're still trying to figure out exactly what EPA has done with their final rule analysis for sugarcane. If you go back to the proposed rule, corn ethanol and sugarcane ethanol from Brazil were assumed to have about the same land use impact. Mm-hmm. In the final rule, the land use emissions for corn ethanol were cut in half, but the land use emissions for Brazil sugarcane ethanol were virtually eliminated altogether. Mm-hmm. And so we're not quite certain why that occurred, and a lot of the supporting analysis that went into the final rule is not yet available. So we're still kind of scratching our heads on that one. When EPA makes all the spreadsheets and supplemental reports and all those things available, we'll maybe have a better understanding of why they took that approach with sugarcane.
Well, let's move to the state level. And California is still their rule for a low carbon fuel standard. It's still penalizing corn ethanol tremendously to the point where it would be locked out of the market essentially. What is going on there, and how can they justify what they're doing compared to now what EPA has done in their final RFS2 rule?
Right. Well, certainly I think the RFS2 rule and EPA's new findings and new approach will put a tremendous amount of pressure on California to revisit their life cycle analysis and specifically their land use change analysis. I firmly believe that if California adopted some of the assumptions that EPA used regarding, distillers' grains usage and future crop yields and ethanol yields and some of these things, if California were to use those same assumptions, it would radically change their analysis. Right now in California, most corn ethanol from the Midwest is considered worse than gasoline in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And because of that, you know, it won't be allowed to play in the California market for very long.
Well, there was a couple of things that struck me about what the EPA lady said. One was that they changed their idea of, as far as indirect land use, in that if they were expanding into grassland, that they were thinking that that would take out forest land. But now they're saying they think it's going to take out more grassland.
Right.
And the other thing was that they realized the inherent uncertainty in their projections, which really got to me. It's like, okay, you're making these projections, and you know that you don't know what's going to happen. And the same thing's going on with California.
Right.
How do you address that with them to say, look, you're making assumptions that may never come true?
Right. Well, I mean, in essence, these are predictions. These modeling exercises that both California and EPA are doing are, you know, one view of what might happen. And, you know, an entire industry is being penalized on one view of how the future might play out. And we're, you know, very concerned with that. The whole uncertainty issue has been really from day one our largest concern with this issue. You simply cannot predict the future with some economic models that you put some assumptions in and they spit out a result. Those models can be used to maybe, you know, guide your thought process and policy development process. But to use these models as regulatory tools with, you know, enforceable penalties is highly problematic. Until we get to a point where we have more certainty with land use change, we still feel that it's not appropriate to include those uncertain effects in these types of regulations.
Now, the RFS2 essentially is going to go into effect, I believe they said June 1st, July 1st. There's going to be some implementation workshops. How is RFA going to help with that?
We've already discussed with EPA the need to do some outreach and education on the RFS2 with our industry. They are very open to that, and as you heard yesterday, they will be holding some implementation workshops. Certainly our role, I think, will be to ensure that everybody in our industry is aware of these workshops and comes prepared to ask questions and learn about how they're going to be affected by these rules. So it's important that everyone participate in that.
Well, because they said that this is actually more complicated than the tax code, right?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, when you look at the thousands of pages now explain the RFS2 program, it is extremely complex in nature. And it's not just the life cycle analysis and the greenhouse gas piece. There's renewable biomass provisions that will have some impacts on ethanol producers, for them to demonstrate compliance. There's a lot of new registration and record-keeping requirements. It really is, from stem to stern, a much more involved program than the RFS1.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff Cooper, here at the National Ethanol Conference. I'm Cindy Zimmerman reporting.